This episode of See Here is dedicated to the estimated 3 million people whose lives were senselessly taken under the regime of the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia. We still remember you. This is See Here.
Episode 64 of the See Here podcast. My name is Morris. I'm here in Melbourne. And joining me are my two esteemed colleagues over in Bath, Mr. Bernard Stickwell.
Good evening.
And over in Brantford, Mr. Tim Merrill.
Howdy.
It feels like it's been ages since we've recorded.
For you.
Well, that's right. Yeah, that's true. I wasn't around in April. So, yes, it feels ages since all three of us. Thank you very much for covering up for me in April.
No, it was our pleasure. And I want to thank Jimmy Lamort for jumping in and helping us sort out the Norwegian black metal scene.
Thanks very much, Jimmy. Much appreciated. And we'll have you back on where all four of us can shoot the shit about a film. That's going to happen. And we know that you have a particular request. This will happen, but we need to make a few arrangements. So the purpose of our gathering today is to discuss a documentary from 2015, and this is a leftover request from last year from Tyler Kennedy. Sorry it's taken us this long to get round to this film, Tyler. I really thought that we needed to do a lot of reading up, but in the end, this film was fairly self-contained. The film that we're talking about is Don't Think I've Forgotten Cambodia's Lost Rock and Roll, documentary by John Perozzi. What we'll do is we'll go play the trailer now, and then we'll come on and discuss a really fascinating film and a really fascinating, hopefully not forgotten, aspect of rock and roll. Okay, you're listening to See Here. We'll be back in a moment.
There is a saying in Cambodia, music is the soul of a nation.
Ils sont très soudés, les musiciens, les chanteurs. Alors c'est toutes sortes de musique moderne chez nous.
I was not a shy kid, you know. I was like, just give me the music, I'll dance.
Like,
this is so cool, it's my generation. I was ready for more, and all of a sudden, it was all gone.
We did get involved in bombing a neutral country.
I can't figure out what we're doing over here in the first place.
In Cambodia or Vietnam?
Anywhere, Cambodia or Vietnam.
The new Cambodia was going to be a revolutionary country and not contaminated by the West.
Si vous voulez éliminer la société, les anciennes valeurs, il faut commencer par éliminer les artistes. Parce que les artistes sont influents. Les artistes sont proches du peuple.
and I'm back from feeding the cat. Meow, meow. Hope it doesn't go and knock on my door again. Anyway, you're listening to episode 64 of See Here, and we're here to discuss the documentary from 2015, directed by John Perozzi, Don't Think I've Forgotten, Cambodia's Lost Rock and Roll. The Wikipedia summary, Don't Think I've Forgotten, is a 2015 documentary film about Cambodian rock music in the 1960s and 1970s, before the Khmer Rouge and the Cambodian genocide. And that's pretty succinct, but pretty much what it encapsulates. Now, before we sort of get into it in any depth, Tim, I know that this is a film that you had seen a few years ago. So what were your initial thoughts when you originally saw it?
Well, I was gutted, to tell you the truth, because, you know, after actually visiting some of these places in Battambang, Phnom Penh, and, you know, Siem Reap, it's really funny because when you see how thriving Cambodia was in the late 50s and the 60s, and you see what they thought they were destined to be, and you see how beautiful it really was. Still, you know, while the French had somewhat, you know, control. And then you go there now, and you see the remnants, and it's almost post-apocalyptic. And seeing that in the film, not to get deep into it, but there's a specific moment in the film that still gives me chills, where they actually show what Cambodia was, and then they go into black and white photographs of what it became, when you just see like the empty husk of Phnom Penh after Pol Pot rolled in and cleared everybody out of the cities. And it's just like this, it's like somebody dropped some type of bomb. It just gutted me to see how happy, it's almost like a relationship, this whole thing, where the beginning is, you know, people full of love and joy and hope, and then everything is shattered on the rocks. And then the end of it is kind of trying to overcome and trying to kind of compensate, and the whole process of dealing with the suffering, you know, or kind of the PTSD of the whole situation, you know. But like I say, I almost look at it like a relationship, you know. The beginning, you get these people deep in love with their country and deep in love with music and deep in love with all of this. And then all of a sudden, it just turns into this nightmare situation that you can't get out of. And then it's just the outcome, and you pick up the pieces and whatever is left, and you try to reassemble a life, reassemble the culture, reassemble the country.
I think like a lot of us comfortable Westerners, I was kind of shamefully, you know, I knew that, you know, things had gone on in Cambodia. I'd heard of the genocide and so on, obviously in Pol Pot, but I didn't actually know the specific details. And, you know, I find this film to be just hugely emotionally affecting and eye-opening, you know, kind of for the reasons that Tim just said, really. I mean, it does go into quite a bit of detail about what happened, about how the Khmer Rouge kind of came to power and what happened subsequently. And it's just heartbreaking. It really is. Again, as Tim was saying, I didn't realize that Cambodia was this kind of beautiful, thriving, almost idyllic kind of place in the late 50s into the 60s.
Right. It was very metropolitan.
Yeah. It just looked wonderful. And the music, you know, I was aware of this stuff. I'd heard maybe the odd track on compilations and so on, but I'd never really kind of dug into it in any detail. So most of this was kind of new to me. Even the stuff that, you know, I'm kind of ashamed that I didn't know about was new to me. This was a very interesting and kind of quick watch.
Like you, I didn't really know a whole lot about the whole Pol Pot regime and what led up to it, so I was doing quite a fair bit of reading. And there's a lot of stuff that I read about that they don't show in the film, and that's probably wise, because for the first hour or so, they want to focus on the music and what made Cambodia right. such a beautiful and thriving right. and culturally right. embracing yeah. sort of place, with just little hints as to what was happening. But basically, you know, what I'd been reading about was after French colonialism had finished and Prince Sihanouk, you know, he was no angel himself, but the film mm-hmm. wants to show that he was someone who embraced culture and he embraced music. And
that's the irony, and the biggest kick in the ass is that he was the one who actually said that all departments in the government had to have their own orchestras, right?
Yeah.
And he was the one that was pushing that music has to be everywhere, the culture has to be everywhere. And yet he goes around and sides with the Cameroons, you know. I mean, and he was duped, you have to admit it. They wind up eliminating everything that he was promoting. I mean, I think that's the biggest kick in the ass to me.
So if I get this right, I don't think he actually sided with the Khmer Rouge until he'd been deposed after the military coup.
He was in exile, wasn't he, at that point?
He was in exile. But I'm just saying he was duped.
Yep.
You know, because he, like he said in the film, like people didn't even know that Pol Pot was their leader.
When the Khmer Rouge had, when they'd sort of rolled in and taken over, he was... instead of having anything to do with the running of the country, he was just prisoner in his own mansion, wasn't he?
Right, right.
But what I found interesting in my reading, and I think like I read this great quote that said that Pol Pot and, I hope I'm pronouncing this right, Nguyen Chia, who is, I think, what was he called, brother number two? The two of them were middle-class guys who'd been educated in French universities.
Right, right.
And then came back to bring extreme agrarian socialism Cambodia.
And that's another thing too that kicks my ass, right? When I was in Cambodia, and I'd only been there for 2 weeks, you know, like visiting friends that were living there that were teaching, but I learned so much, like just by asking people questions, you know. And I sat in a coffee shop in Phnom Penh with a fella, older fella, one day, and he said to me, he said, just by the fact that you have glasses on your face, you'd be dead. You would be considered an intellectual because of the fact that you wear glasses. You read because you have glasses, and therefore you're an intellectual. What kicks my ass is the fact that Pol Pot and his cronies go to outside of the country to get educated, to become intellectuals.
Yeah.
They come back and they basically choke it out of everybody else.
Well, that's how you rule, though, isn't it? You get rid of the thinking people, the idea people.
As the film sort of makes out, that if you're a businessman, if you're a theologian, or if you're an artist, you are capable of coming up with your own thoughts. And it's not so much that you're an intellectual that they objected to. It's the fact that you're going to have different thoughts to our thoughts. We are now in control. You cannot object to our thoughts.
Right. But to them, an intellectual was the person that was the free thinker, is what you're saying. Like, that was the idea, was that anybody who was an intellectual or anybody who, you know, had a half a brain in their head could basically steer left or center. They wanted to go in their own way. Bong ơi ơi bong bong khăng rương vây bàn chia xa đây plain không thòm đò ta bong khăng ô từ khăng đen.
There's a long story that goes between the time that French colonialism finished, the rule of Prince Sihanouk and how he encouraged culture, the war in Vietnam spilling into Cambodia, the military overthrow of Prince Sihanouk in, I think it was 1970, then Pol Pot taking over with Year Zero in 1975 and his rule between 75 and 79 and the murder of millions of people. So the film, I guess, especially in the second half of the film, because it's unavoidable, they do talk a lot about what happened during the Pol Pot rule, but quite wisely, I think, for the purpose of letting the focus be on the music and all that made Cambodia so culturally vibrant and exciting up until that point, they focus a lot on the musicians. And probably, I guess, if you'd ask John Barozzi, he could say, look, there are tons of books, tons of documentaries out there that explain that side of it. I'm electing to tell a different story, so tell what we need.
That's not what this film is about, is it?
No, problem is that the whole subject matter is just so dense. There's just so much to this. You're just looking at, for example, like Motown in Detroit. You could talk about the whole United States, but you just have to focus on Motown, right? It's so hard because when Pol Pot and these thugs roll in, it's like music, politics, everything's all one and the same. But like you say, he wisely kind of veers away from getting into all the deep think politic and gets into this focus on the music.
As you said, Morris, he does a very good job of just dropping little hints, little news reports and things like that throughout the first sort of half or three quarters of the film. If you know anything about history, you know things are going to get bad and they're going to deal with that. Like I say, he does a good job of kind of foreshadowing what is going to happen without it being quite that.
One thing I really love the way he foreshadows with this documentary is how he actually uses the lyrics in the music. And half of these songs were not written about these things, but it just so seems that a lot of the songs that he chooses to as the bed that he play underneath these scenes and what they're talking about out. The lyrics just nail it 100%.
I can't remember which song. There was something like particularly late in the film that may have done that. I think that was more like in the late 60s, you know, just when, right. we'll sort of get to the development of the music over the period of time, but just like where in Western society, lyrics were getting to be more about sticking the finger to the man or objection right. to what was happening with America being in Vietnam and youth wanting to have a voice. So there was something of that, particularly with, say, the music of Yol Olorong. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. They said that he was something of a humorist, of a right. smart aleck, and he could write songs that were maybe objecting to policy, but also he was just writing smart-ass songs that were right. maybe, you know, disrespectful of the previous generation, which is not something that in the early days someone like Sin Sismuth would have.
I was thinking in particular, there's one scene in the film where after the king has been deposed, I forget the female singer, where she's singing, "You were a traitor, you broke my heart." And then she's just talking about heartbreak, but it's really effective when you see the king being hauled out and she's singing this song of people in the street. I like that.
The other point I wanted to make about this film, we've already gone and said that the second half of the film focuses a lot more on what was happening with the military coup and with Pol Pot's regime. But even there, the music still comes into it, because we've got the first half of the film where music, the development as being a cultural entity and everyone's love of popular music and the artists who performed it. But then there's the contrast under Pol Pot's regime, where music is being used in a propagandistic sort of way. We will give duty to our country. We will serve the needs of the people.
Jingoistic yeah. is basically what it is. But one thing you wouldn't hear anybody singing was, "War, good God, what is good for? Absolutely nothing." No, that guy, you know, is gone, long gone.
I remember, Tim, we had a yak on Skype about a week ago or so, and you said something really interesting about the nature of music being politicized. In the West, we often sort of think of political music as songs that are protesting against a government or some act of solidarity with an oppressed people. But you said that the very fact that there were songs that were being made, like in the early 70s, under the military regime, like this is still before Pol Pot came, and the fact that people right. were then, even while Pol Pot, they made this very good point that while some of the performers who were hugely popular in the 60s were then sent to work in the fields, they said that the one thing that could keep them going, that they couldn't be hauled away from, was while they were working, they would sing these old songs to themselves. And that was their political act of defiance.
The funny thing is that unless you silence a voice, that voice is power. You look at back in American slavery, you know, where they used to sing spirituals working in the fields, it's the same thing. These slave owners, they could put these people under the end of a whip and make them toil in the field, but they couldn't take away their power, because these people could still sing, they could still express their discontent. And that's what happened even in Cambodia, even though subversive as it was, just in the act of being able to just open your mouth and utter certain things, you're able to basically, you know, stick your hand up in the air and, you know, give them the bird and say, "I'm not happy with what's going down."
Snipe
Let's talk a bit about the music itself, because that's really what made me smile, and I'm sure it made you two guys smile as well. One thing that I thought was interesting, there's a large part of the film where they're talking about the man who I think they believe was the father of modern Cambodian music, Sin Sisimuth. If you think about music in the West, and I mean, okay, yeah, sure, Frank Sinatra is given a lot of credit and a lot of love amongst certain types of fans, but I think rock and roll came along and was attempting to sweep out that generation of music that had just come before it. Sin Sisimuth, while I'm not suggesting he was necessarily Cambodia's Frank Sinatra, but he started out as a crooner, and obviously as music went on and changed, he decided, well, I want to be part of that. But I just find it interesting that the angle that the film takes is not modern performers had to sweep away the crooners. It's like everyone got respect, and that's so different from if we were looking at a documentary about the history of American or British rock and roll. If you're making a British film, you wouldn't necessarily be including music hall artists, or the closest you might get would be Lonnie Donegan.
Skiffle.
The skiffle would be the start of it. It's still not full on rock and roll, but that's as close as you'd get. Whereas this movie is celebrating everything.
I think that there's quite a kind of Western way of looking at things though, isn't it? The kind of canon and how rock and roll comes along and sweeps away all the crooners and the what have you beforehand, and how punk then comes along and kind of knocks rock and roll out of the way and so on and so forth. It's very Western, but other countries and other parts of the world, they don't follow our musical development in a sense. It, you know, what makes sense to us isn't going to make sense to them. And I guess in this case, as far as Sin Sisimuth is concerned, it's all music. This right. is just the current thing, and so I'm moving into that because this is what's current and people like it, not a fuck off granddad kind of thing. It's
no. I think that in other parts of the world they've taken the Louis Armstrong aspect, in the sense that they say there's two kinds of music: there's good music and there's bad music.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think that, you know, in the West, everybody throws labels on things to claim ownership. The thing is, like I've always said, like you talk about punk, how much more punk can you get when you're actually writing stuff that's anti-establishment in an environment where you could actually lose your life over it?
Yeah.
Dylan, as much as, you know, I like Dylan, for him to sing Blowing in the Wind, there wasn't any retribution. There wasn't any negative outcome for Dylan in particular.
Yeah, he wasn't going to end up in an unmarked grave somewhere.
Exactly. He wasn't going to be lynched for what he did. That's where I see it being really revolutionary. And the fact that the beginning of the film actually says that there's an old saying in Cambodia that music is kind of like the heart of a country, of a nation, you know, that music is kind of the lifeblood of any society.
It sounds cliched to say it, but that's what at the core this film is about. It's about the power of music, and it really is, because you had the political opponents saying, right, you are forbidden to do that sort of thing. But music and ideas made people feel wonderful, as was evidenced by Prince Sihanouk encouraging it and having government departments devoted to it and encouraging Sin Sisimuth, as they say earlier on in the film, to come and work in the Royal Orchestra. And he learnt a whole new way of singing that he had not previously done. Coming to your point, Tim, you know, saying just imagine if you were to be doing a documentary about the history of Motown. So my thought is that you couldn't do it justice in a movie. You should have had like a 10-part miniseries.
Oh, yeah.
And really watching that, I just wanted more and more. And I thought, well, this is only a 90-minute film. Damn it. I wish that they could have like a 10-part series. Let's have an episode just on Sin Sisimuth and another one on Roz Seri-Suthir. And you guys were saying, well, they did things differently to Western countries, and yet they were taking a lot of their inspiration
Western
music, but they were putting their spin on it. And that's what made it so exciting.
Well, that's one thing that's so unique in their situation. It was like, you know, you basically, there was three primary influences that were coming in. I mean, like, you got the French aspect with like Johnny Holiday and all of that, and then Cliff Richard and the Shadows, and then with the Americans in with Vietnam with Armed Forces Radio. I love that one aspect of the film where, you know, you know they're playing Otis and he's singing Everybody Needs Somebody, and, you know, it's just, it really fit the film. Like, it was really a great moment. To go back for a second, I kind of mulled over something that we just talked about a couple of minutes ago, about the idea that everybody got props in Cambodia, everybody got respect. I'm no authority on, I don't know jack shit, okay? But from living in Asia for a number of years, the one thing that I really gleaned out of my experience is that there's a whole thing about the respect of your ancestors, the respect of your family, the respect of your elders. You're just an echo of something that was dropped a long time ago. and you know it. Whereas in the West, no one really wants to know about any of the past and anything that your dad did or your granddad did or your great-granddad did. It's all forgotten. In Asia, your blood is not your own. You carry it. You carry on the traditions and the ways. And this is one thing now with the new century and everything coming on. There's a disconnect for a lot of the older people that feel kind of heartbroken because a lot of the younger generation aren't willing anymore to really carry on the old traditional folk songs in many countries and the traditional dances and the traditional ways. And they're trying to continue to promote that, right? But I think that was something that was really prevalent in Cambodia, was that they did carry on their traditional dance and the traditional songs, and that everybody did recognize what the previous generations did. That's an aspect that is really, really significant in Asian culture.
You can really hear that in a lot of the music in the film, because even though it is taking these other influences, and even though it's, you know, outright aping Western songs at points, there's still something very definitely Cambodian about it. There's something very unique, whether it be a vocal style or, you know, a kind of phrase on the guitar or even the production on some of the songs, things like that. It just, you could tell it's part of a long line. That makes sense.
In Asian culture, if somebody's remotely related to you, you call them uncle or auntie. And the one fellow saying, you know, they called me Uncle Solo and I was only 14 years old. You know, and he's just basically trying to ape Johnny Kidd and the Pirates or the Shadows. And this is the thing, man, that you really have to wrap your head around the absolute lack of technology that they had. I mean, today, you know, with our Spotify and our just everything is instantaneous. I mean, back then, there was no cassettes. There was just vinyl. I like the idea that they, when the one fellow was talking about in Pen on Pen, where all the cyclo, what the woman was talking about, cyclo, which were kind of like almost like tuk-tuks or like the rickshaw drivers. So how they were all hanging out in front of the radio station because they put a big speaker out on the wall outside. So this is where these guys would go and relax, because they didn't even have access to an actual transistor radio, a lot of these people. But it was still being almost like biologically transmitted, the music. It was getting to everybody by hook or by crook, by one way or another, and they needed it. But today, that's the irony, is we have access to a million things that we could go out and grab in a second, and we don't.
And none of it sticks.
But yeah, these people, you know, they would all go and hang outside around a local place or like a local radio station where they would play this music, and that's how they got it. Or else there was like Merchant Marine or all kinds of different ways that the people would broadcast, but that's how they got it. Or when the one fella talks about the first actual music record store in Pen on Pen, where the guy started to buy vinyl. Yeah. It was just,
I love the fact that somebody says at some point that they're talking about the Bayon band,
right?
Which was, you know, the kind of the Cambodian equivalent of the Shadows or something,
right,
like
the
that.
Surf guitar, yeah.
Yeah, they were called Baksi Cham Krong.
Right, Baksi Cham Krong.
I sort of see that as, like, in the context of the film anyway, they were the next evolution from at least how Sin Sizimuth and Chuan Malay and Rosseri Sothia. They started out as the crooners. Of course, mind you, their own music evolved over time, which is amazing. I mean, you couldn't really imagine Frank Sinatra doing something remotely rock and roll, but these people did. And, but, you know, Baksi Cham Krong, I think the guitar player said, oh yeah, we were watching footage of Hank in the Shadows and, you know, Cliff Richard. Even that evolved. I think the guitarist from that left and started up in another band. And then as the film progresses, they start up this other band, Draka.
Just
which is very much taking its lead from Otis Redding and Wilson Pickett. I just got to sort of chime in here. I've made note of a few songs that I really, really liked in the film. There are a few songs, I listened to this album, which I know you were a big fan of, Tim, called Cambodian Rocks, Tim. And I sort of like that album in a way a lot better than the soundtrack for the film. And the soundtrack of the film is great, but the title is completely accurate, Cambodian Rocks. And Sinsizimuth, just to show his evolution, he does a song that's not on the soundtrack, but it's on this Cambodian Rocks album, that translates as I Love Petite Girl. And it's basically, whatever the lyrics are, I don't know, but it's basically him taking Black Magic Woman by Santana and
right.
him doing his own lyrics on that. And you've got to just hand it over to the musicians on this, because the guitar player has got incredible chops, and these guys, they're the equal of anyone in Santana. It's absolutely amazing. But just
right.
Sinsizimuth didn't change, at least to my ears, his vocal approach from those early crooning type songs to what he's doing here. He's still singing the way how he does, but just the fact that he decided, oh well, that's what people are listening to and I rather like that, I'll do it, didn't sound the least bit like he was just trying to jump on a financial bandwagon. He was just doing, right, well, this is where music's going, this is what I got to do.
Right. On the Cambodian Rocks album, there's a, it's not very subtle, but there's an actual kind of a version of Booker T and the MG's Hip Hugger.
That's right, yeah, that's Liv Took, Rom Susuk.
Right, Rom Susuk, and he's actually singing lyrics over it, where there's no lyrics in the original song. It's almost like cooking, you know, where you're taking a recipe from somewhere else and putting the local spin on it. You're putting your own spice in it, you know? And I love that. And then they got to a point where they actually said, listen, we don't have to be a mimic of these groups. We can actually go closer to our own culture and take the old traditional songs or take some of the traditional rhythms and mix in a little bit of the West. But then they were leaning into more confidence with their own styles, with their own music. The initial excitement of hearing, you know, Hendrix or hearing Otis Redding or any of this stuff had worn off, I think. And they started to say, look, you know, we can get into our own. We can find our own footing instead of just kind of sitting in the shadows and going, oh yeah, that's really cool, man. I want to try to...
I got to ask you something. Did his voice sound to you like Screamin' Jay Hawkins in a higher register?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I believe he's been compared to James Brown, but I just really got the Screamin' Jay Hawkins feel about him.
In Cambodia, let's just say that certain substances have yet to be illegalized. You know, when you hear some of the recordings, it just sounds like some of these guys are just completely off of their ass, man. Like it just sounds like some of these guys are just going gonzo. They just put on so much distortion in some of the recordings, or it's just hilarious. The first time I heard this, it sounded like caveman primal stomp, some of the stuff.
Big part of the charm though, isn't it?
Right, absolutely.
Yeah.
But I don't know if it was because of lack of the recording equipment or these guys getting into a little bit of the local juice, or like I don't know what it was. There's something really raw about the Cambodian rock that makes it, you know, they put their definite stamp on it, but it's just, you know, it's like, woo, like this stuff is really groovy. It's got a bite to it.
I like to think that unlike the West, what was developing certainly in the late 60s, I'd like to imagine that these songs were recorded fairly spontaneously. There was no slaving over getting
right.
a drum sound right, or we're going to take 6 months to record this album
right.
or anything like
right,
this.
Right, right,
just get a
right.
bunch of people in a studio who have amazing musician chops and vocal technique, and they just bang, 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 put them out.
Now, you guys have to understand something, too, that I think that is important with this as well, is that You know about the cargo cult phenomena? Well, like in the South Pacific, they used to have these cargo planes that would fly long hauls, and sometimes they'd crash on these tropical islands in the South Pacific, and the natives, they'd find boxes of food or goods, and then they'd find, dead pilots or whatever, and then they thought they were like gods that fell out of the sky. So then they basically try to set up the radio and set everything up so they could get another one to come down to give them treasures and rewards and stuff. So what happened was anthropologists or sociologists have said there's this thing kind of like a cargo cult phenomena where you get inklings of something, but you really can't quite wrap your head around what it is. So you basically try to mimic it the best you can. But even by trying to mimic it, you're actually putting your own spin on it, making it better in a weird way. You're doing it in a local way that you know how. You're not completely filled in and exactly able to duplicate it 100%, the outside influence, but you're trying to do the best you can. So in a way, there are kind of semi-rules, but in another way, there's no rules. Because there's no rules, in some ways, you take it into interpretation into places that no one ever anticipated. I mean, like, for example, not to, veer off of what we're talking about, but like you look in Japan, like a band like Guitar Wolf.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. And where they took American rock and roll and they just ran with it, man. Like, just beyond. That's why today, like a lot of American music aficionados or Western music aficionados say, well, we go and do something and then the Japanese or the Germans have done it better or somebody else has done it better, right? It's because of this kind of, like I say, like a cargo cult phenomena where people
pick it up and run with it.
Pick it up and run with it because they don't understand 100% of initially what it really is all about. And I think that's what makes the Cambodian rock and roll so beautiful, if that makes any sense.
And I think John Perazzi has, by and large, he's done a fantastic job in conveying that, exactly how Cambodian musicians and culture as a whole thrived in that 60s period because they were taking things and making it their own. You never got this sense of, oh, they're just copying. Bernie, you said like a few minutes ago, they were putting their own vocal technique. And I think a lot of that uniqueness compared to singers compared to the songs of the West was that vocal technique, and it's sort of operatic in a way.
It's a very sort of classicist way of you can tell that it's something that people have been doing for years. It's not a gruff rock and roll style.
That's just it, though. They said, like what I was just talking about, remembering the past and continuing to respect the past. That's what it is.
The Khmer Rouge kept their own agenda secret. Sihanouk didn't even know that Pol Pot was their leader.
We've gone and spoken a fair bit here about the music and the events. Were you both satisfied as to how John Perazzi presented these events and the order of things and bringing in just little bits of danger in the first half before coming back to the music? Would you have liked to have seen more of any one thing?
I think it works perfectly, the way he's structured it, and as we were saying before, the way he drops little hints as to the direction things are heading. And I think one thing I've taken away from it is I'm going to read up, I'm going to do some research, I'm going to find out more about what did happen. And I think that's something good to take away from this. I don't think the film would have been better if he'd focused more on the Khmer Rouge regime, or if he'd focused less on that. I think he's got the balance exactly right, that he's kind of piqued my curiosity about the music and the sort of politics that were going on at the time. So as a result, I'm going to read up, I'm going to actually learn some things. That's really great if a film can make you do that.
I like the fact that how one thing can lead to the next, like this whole domino effect. I believe that Matt Perazzi had been working on Matt Dillon's film City of Ghosts in Cambodia, and it's only because he heard the Cambodian Rocks album, which I believe is a bootleg actually, but I don't like to use the term bootleg. I'd like to think of it as more like a great collection and archive, if you will. Someone had taken the time to put these songs, which have possibly been forgotten by the next generation. And he heard this and thought, this is absolutely amazing, and decided, right, well, I need to investigate this more. So in a way, I think that his film was a result of a lot of detective work. I mean, if you were going to make, as you say, Tim, a film about Motown, Chinatown or a film right. about the MC5 or whatever. There's a lot of stuff out there. There's a lot of people you can interview. Whereas this, a lot of the musicians and their collaborators were killed under the Pol Pot regime. And even at the end of the film, they go and say, well, we saw this person in this. Actually, yeah, it was, I think Sin Sisymuth's son was saying, well, I heard from 10 different people that they saw my father in this camp, or they saw him in this field, and he died under this circumstance, and they can't all be right. And maybe none of them are right. But I think that that's the sad thing that you take away at the end of the film. I mean, obviously, besides a senseless murder of 1.5 million people because of a ruling ideology, just with the focus of this film on the music, is these people who we were smiling along with in the first half because they went and created something wonderful. The relatives, they don't have that closure. They don't know really. They presume what happened to them, but they don't know under what circumstances. And that's tragedy on a large scale and tragedy on a smaller scale.
I'm in no position whatsoever to speak for anybody who's Khmer. But just as a visitor, as a mere observer, there's such a weight that is in that country that it's really beyond scale to really comprehend. You feel it. You feel it. And the people that are living there to this day, they make no bones about what has happened. And it is what it is. And there's no other way of looking at it. You can't deny it. You can't over emote. The killing fields are not one place. There are like dozens and dozens and dozens of places. Everywhere you go, somebody is ready to tell you that there's dead buried here and there's dead buried there and there's dead buried somewhere else. And after a while, you just have to go with it, because if you don't, you really can't stay there. It's just overwhelming. But I want to say one thing, though, and not to downplay in any way whatsoever anything that happened in Cambodia, but watching this documentary and just the feeling I got, like I said, about a relationship earlier, this to me, in a way, is almost like the Tina Turner story. In the beginning, she was making this music and she was free. It was amazing. And her husband, Ike, you know, they really, all they were concerned with was just being happy and making music. And then it gets into this situation where she's forced to make music under duress in a violent situation. And it's like, how am I going to get out from under this and still keep myself? And then in the end, you know, she picks up the pieces and she's free and she's left the legacy. And I mean, of course, she didn't die. Again, I'm not trying to, you know, downplay anything that happened in Cambodia. But to me, this whole situation is like a relationship. I really see it. People in Cambodia will tell you the same thing, that there was like a romance in the late 50s and in the 60s that turned into this whole nightmare situation where, you know, the people that you're supposed to love and trust that come in under the guise of taking care of you ultimately turn around to be the worst thing that could ever happen to you. And in the end, when you manage to reef your way free of it and you pick up the pieces, there's a lot of things that are left behind that unfortunately there's those that didn't get out. But does that make sense, what I'm saying, like about a relationship?
I think this is the only podcast where or possibly the only place ever that can be likened to Tina and Ike Turner's relationship.
Every podcast has to mark its territory, Bernie.
I think John Perosi did consider how much must have been lost during those years. Many songs, how much recorded music, how much film footage must just not exist anymore.
Oh, yeah, because the year zero, I mean, they eliminated so much.
So it's amazing he was able to kind of find what he did, really. And it's great that it's, you know, there's stuff still there and we're able to kind of tap into it and appreciate it.
I was going to bring up, I'd forgotten that there were those moments where we did see some level of performance footage. And I wanted to know, I mean, were they part of feature-length movies, like scenes in movies where there was a band playing or there was something that was filmed specifically? I'm not just like necessarily talking about the Drakkar band footage that you might see later on. There were moments where you would see singing and it just looked like there was performing in a nightclub, and it looked like, oh, I wonder if this is from a movie or something like that. So, yeah, good point.
One thing that a lot of people don't realize, and I read this in several places, is when people knew that a lot of stuff was going down with the Khmer Rouge, a lot of stuff was buried. They actually had time capsules.
They kind of hid stuff.
Hid stuff. Yeah. There was a lot of stuff that was hid. People buried, like they had lockboxes, or there was a lot of stuff that was buried. Well, most of it, the majority was birth certificates, land records of people owning farming land. But there was a lot of old reels of film and reels of recordings and vinyl. Like there were things that they did manage to salvage. Yeah, when I was in Siem Reap, actually, I went to a museum where you could actually still see some of the old things, like old music books. I remember that they had music books of recordings of traditional Khmer songs, and they had vinyl, and they had old clothing, and a whole bunch of stuff that the museums now are archiving. And they're still, to this day, going through rice fields, and they're going through abandoned areas to try to not only find the remains of people that were basically killed by the Khmer Rouge, but they're also finding their possessions as well.
I was reading this book a few years ago. I've forgotten the name of the author, but she was doing this investigation into the history of 78, and I think at one point she goes to somewhere in the south, I think, and learns how to go deep diving. So she goes to the bottom of this.
Oh, I know. Yes, I've got the same book.
Pretty sure she was like in a documentary that we all recently watched as well. And she goes to the bottom of this river to see if she can scavenge what was rumored to be a whole bunch of old Paramount 78s.
Oh, that was in the one about John Fahey, wasn't it?
Amanda Petrusich.
That's the one, Amanda Petrusich.
World obsessive hunt for the world's rarest 78 RPM records. That's the one, isn't it?
Yes, that's the one. And I just find it interesting that where there's a love and passion for your culture, the depths to what people will do to try and preserve it. And that's what she was attempting to do there. And just coming back to your point, Tim, about even in the post-Pol Pot Cambodia, love of music and culture and wanting to preserve. There's that mentality that they want to go out and find these old records or old music books. And with the wonderful work that John Perozzi has done to do his detective work, so Westerners can at least get even just the tip of the iceberg as to how thriving this culture was.
When my friend Gary lived there, and when I was there for the 2 weeks, we kind of bombed around Phnom Penh, and we went around Siem Reap looking for the old music. And the only thing we were able to find was some of these guys were laughing at us, asking us, like, why do you want that? And then they'd pull out these old CDRs and blow off some dust. And they were like these bootleg, these cellophane wrappers that would be like a laser printed cover. And it was almost like buying some demo disc or demo CD or something. And a lot of it was old Khmer wedding music. Some of it was a little bit of rock and roll, but to try to find the real deal, they didn't have any record stores anymore in Phnom Penh and Siem Reap. Like, to modern people, the past is the past. I mean, the young kids, they're more interested in Lady Gaga and Drake or whatever, you know, like they're not into that. Because, I mean, like, to us, that still seems like within, you know, our lifespan. But when you really look back at it, we're talking about, you know, almost 100 years ago now. Like, well, what, 60, 70 years ago?
Yeah. So, yeah, it's a lifetime ago for young kids, isn't it? It's two lifetimes ago.
Right. So you can't really expect them now to glom onto that.
Even though it brings us together to do this every month, the internet just makes we're all one big global mush now, and we all have access to everything from everywhere. So tradition, I think, is a harder thing. Was harder and harder to maintain tradition because of that, you know.
But it also allows for those people who do want to have traditions maintained to put it out there and say, hey, check this out, there's something that didn't
use
modern recording techniques and was part of another time. But this film is not just about the music, but it's about how these people experienced it, how much they treasured it. We can only sort of like appreciate it as a group of terrific songs, whereas the people who lived it were growing up with it. You know, I mean, you might remember growing up in Brantford or in Bath or me here in Melbourne the first time you heard a particular song and what right. was happening in your life. You have that lived experience. And for the people who were living under Prince Sihanouk at the time, they remember, right, I was doing this at the time, or this is what was happening in my backyard at the time. Nowadays, it's still great to have the music, and we can appreciate it on an intellectual level, and we can even appreciate it as a great piece of music, but it becomes an artifact in a way. It's not the same.
That kind of almost sense memory almost of music can carry. It's a different thing, yeah.
I think the music, it's a matter of faith. These people that, you know, recorded all these songs in the 50s and 60s knew that their lives would eventually come to an end. And they had to have the faith that, well, if I see something in this music that I'm recording and making, then maybe down the line somebody else will see something in the music that I recorded and made. And if they do, great, that's fantastic. If they don't, they don't. But you put it out there into the ether and it flies. It's like a paper airplane. Either it soars or it doesn't. I mean, but there's nothing that you can be around to see the resonating effects of what you've done. And that's the kind of power of this music, is that there's a lot of garage enthusiasts, I know, they get into the Kamai garage rock stuff because, you know, just for the novelty of it. But when you really look at the significance of what, like you're saying, what it meant to these people, and the fact that a lot of them are not around to see the resonating effects of it, to me, like, that's pretty profound.
Yeah. That Cambodian Rocks album really could be released legitimately and called Cambodian Nuggets, because that's what it is. You know, just these great 60s rock and roll artifacts, and they're just nuggets. They're gems of,
exactly.
Of music and these people's experience.
I'd love to see somebody like a Cambodian Alan Lowe. Lomax, you know what I mean?
Absolutely. Well, I mean, well, in a way, John Perozzi has probably come as close as there would be to to an Alan Lomax, although he's doing it once again from a Westerner's perspective, but it's someone with deep empathy, I guess. Look, I'd really hope that someone would trawl through as much as there is out there.
I want to make a statement right here and right now. For as long as we've been doing the show, See Here, and if you're hearing this for the first episode, or you've listened to all of them or whatever, I don't want to be presumptuous, I implore anybody who listens to our show to see this film, to find this film, because I think this is one of the most relevant films that we've covered yet. Mm. This one and the one that we did, like I said, about the John Fahey film.
Two Trains Running.
Yep.
Two Trains Running. Yeah, those two films, to me, this and Two Trains Running, are the two most, to me, important films that we've covered to date.
Right. Well, this film is available either on iTunes, or if you're a member of a public library, and we'd like to hope that you are, then you should join canopy.com. Canopy, for those of you who don't know, is a streaming service, free streaming service. All they ask is that you're a member of a public library and you register via your library card, and it's available in some parts of the world on canopy.com. The film is out there and easily accessible for you to watch. And yeah, I 100% two thumbs up. Definitely go search this out. You'll find some new favorite musicians and new favorite singers. These songs are great. Some are based on Western songs. Actually, there was probably a moment where I teared up a little bit just sort of hearing towards the end of the film, forgotten the name of the singer, shame on me, who does her interpretation of You've Got a Friend. It's interesting that she does it partly in Khmer and partly in English.
Right, when he's reading the letter about the man who sent him the letter, the American ambassador.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
And that moment in the film absolutely tore my heart out. Absolutely, from all three of us. We wholeheartedly recommend this film.
You owe it to these people, like the people that are unfortunately, because of political circumstance, no longer able to basically speak for themselves, and the survivors as well, who went through such a hellish traumatic experience, and now they still have the liberty to listen to the music that they created, and that other people can appreciate the music they created. I think that if you really love music, you owe it to yourself, like I say, to see this movie and to seek out some of the Khmer Cambodian music, because even the traditional music is fantastic. All of it is wonderful.
Yep, get the soundtrack. Cambodian Rocks is available in its entirety on YouTube if you want to hear it that way, probably on Spotify, I imagine.
I was going to say they're both on Spotify as well, certainly in the UK, so... I'm
All right, well, that's big wholehearted recommendation for Don't Think I've Forgotten Cambodia's Lost Rock and Roll from the See Here team. So just quickly talk about next month. No, it's this month. We're releasing two episodes this month. It's June 2019. So episode 65. Unfortunately, Tim and Bernie aren't going to be able to be a part of it because of the timing for this, but I'll be joined by my good friend Paul Ryan. Not that Paul Ryan. Local script writer, great friend of myself and the show. We're going to be doing an interview with Australian film director Gillian Armstrong. You may know her from a whole range of films. She's made some stuff in America, redid Little Women probably. Her most famous film is her debut, My Brilliant Career. But we're going to be talking to her about her second film. Came out in 1982, was a big hit in Australia, a film called Starstruck. And I know a few people have gone and said, you do a music film podcast, why don't you talk about Starstruck? Well, we're doing it. So very, very excited to be speaking to Gillian Armstrong about that film. That'll be episode 65 out later this month. And what else? If you wish to join our Facebook group, then you can join us at facebook.com/groups/seehear, S-W-H-E-A-R. We're on Spotify. We're on Stitcher. You can download us from the website seehere.podbean.com. You can email us at seeherepodcast@gmail.com.
And we're on Instagram as well, seeherepodcast, all one word.
Mm-hmm. Any new photos up?
There will be in the next 5 minutes or so.
Excellent. Excellent. All right. So now having done this, having covered this film, and once again, huge thanks to you, Tyler Kennedy, for making that suggestion. We have now cleared our backlog of requests for 2018. So given that we're halfway through the year, maybe we'll leave it till 2020 before we open the lines up for a request on the Facebook page. But having said that, if you have a request, just put it through. We're pretty laid back about that sort of stuff. I'll speak to you guys offline as to what we're going to be doing in July of 2019. So I'll give that game away.
I gotta say something right now. Immediate announcement. Rocky Erickson has just passed away.
Oh, what?
No.
You're just saying that
kidding?
Now.
Yeah, he just passed away.
Oh, jeez. Oh, man.
Well, we can't cover the Rocky Erickson story for July 2019 because we've already done that, but please.
Go back, listen to that episode. Yeah. Play some Elevators records.
Yes, absolutely.
Here's to the two-headed dog. Oh, man.
Way to keep it uplifting at the end of the show, Tim. Thanks.
Cheers.
All right, well, go back and listen to Cambodian Rocks. Go back and listen to some 13th Floor Elevators. Just celebrate music. It's all wonderful. And until episode 65, all the best. Cheers.
Cheers.
Thanks, Rocky. Sleep tight.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Frenino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune into Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.